All right, guys, let's begin. Sorry I didn't bring an outline. The copier in the library didn't have a printer cartridge, so.
Did you need to make copies out there?
No, because I don't have an outline. It's on my computer. It's on my computer, but I'll just do like I do when I preach. I'll just give you my outline up front, and you can listen along. So, I want to begin with a little quotation, sort of an unexpected way of beginning our topic, a pastor as writer. And so recently I was contacted by a member of a congregation in our federation that has a vacant pulpit, asking if I'd be willing to be considered as a candidate for that pulpit. And the answer, well, I asked some questions, and one of the answers I got from one of my emails sealed the deal for me. And I'll tell you why. I'm going to read this in just a moment. So here's what, this is a member in the URC, so this gives you a sense of what's going on out there. The email says in part, there's a growing restlessness in the congregation for, quote, something more. In my opinion, it is the hunger of being Christian and not being fed. It is the preaching of the gospel that they are hungry for, although they would probably think that is what they've had all along, but it isn't. What we have had is a steady diet of law and morality and works and tradition, interrupted by occasional flashes of gospel and freedom and light. There seems to be a, quote, default mode at work here, because in the minds of most people, preservation of the status quo is equated with Christian piety. The generations coming into adulthood can see the duplicity that exists within a community that confesses grace and gospel but lives law and works. The contradiction is exacerbated from Lord's Day to Lord's Day, with a pulpit ministry that miscommunicates the very message that is supposed to be our lifeline to God. So, yeah. Who wants to take that call? Anybody? So, why do I begin that way? Well, I begin that way, it's not to sadden you or to damper any enthusiasm for the ministry of the church, but what we have here at the seminary and what we have learned, for those of us who are done and for those of you who are here, what you are learning, needs to be taught, preached, and written about. We need to be in churches like this and to explain to people Christ. Jesus Christ as the one who has worked for us in justification and who has continued and does continue to work in us, in our sanctification, the one who is the sum and substance of the whole of the Bible. People in our churches need to hear Christ, and they need to see that in the pastor. They need to see him live that, and they need to see that modeled. So we need to, as seminary students, Westminster grads, realize the treasure that we have and not forget that. So, and I've seen many experiences and situations like this. This is not atypical. This is sort of the normal status quo in a lot of our churches. So just really to encourage you, to exhort you at the beginning, I'm not your pastor, I am for some of you, but not all of you, but to exhort you nonetheless that what you have here, don't take it for granted, because what you have, most people don't, and they don't realize that. So we need to, in our persons and in our preaching and in print, explain Christ to people, just like this brother who wrote me this very sad email. So that kind of leads us into our topic, the pastor as writer. We're called to be pastors, called to be shepherds, called to be preachers, called to be teachers, and also, as I am convicted, also ministers are called to be writers. So just a couple of things that I want to mention today. First of all, the first main idea that we want to think about is that writing is an extension of the ministry of the word. Okay, that's the first point. Writing is an extension of the ministry of the word. Then secondly, I'm going to give you some just really basic. Second point is usually a throwaway point for me, so it's the quickest one paragraph. Usually, you can ask Dan or Jared. I'm just getting warmed up by 30 minutes, so I've done like one point in 30 minutes. Second point's got to go quick because people are dying to get out of there. So, second point, just some benefits of the pastor as writer. And then finally, I'll give you some advice on the pastor becoming a writer. So it's an extension of the ministry of the word. What are some benefits of writing? And then give you some practical tips. that I've learned and that others have learned over the years. So, writing is an extension of the ministry of the Word. We see this, of course, in the Bible. We're not inspired by no stretch of the imagination, but we see it in the prophets and in the apostles. They not only preached the Word, but they also wrote it. So they ministered the Word in speech and in scrolls. And there are examples to us of what it means to be a minister, what it means to be a servant of the Word. And we learn a lesson from the prophets' examples and the apostles. Again, we're not inspired, but the lesson is something I think is true, that we are called not only to preach to our people's ears, but they need to read with their eyes the things that are found in the Word, whether it's the Word itself or whether it's explanation of the Word. So it is an extension of the ministry of the Word. We see that at least as an example in the Bible. We also see in our own form of subscription that those of us as ministers have had to sign our names to, and should God call you to the ministry, you'll also sign your name on the bottom of that form of subscription. And there's a long, great history of that form. You can read a little essay by Dr. Godfrey. It's in that book, The Practice of Confessional Subscription. He gives a brief summary of the history of our form of subscription. And there's also a PhD thesis that just came out on that form. If you want to email me, I can give you the link. You can read it online for free. It's some obscure Dutch publisher. If you want to spend like $300, you can buy the hard copy. I think they made like 20 copies. But if you want to read it online, it's available online. Part of that form says this, after it explains the creeds, of the confessions and so forth that we have. We promise, therefore, diligently to teach and faithfully to defend the aforesaid doctrine, without either directly or indirectly contradicting the same by our public preaching, teaching, or writing. So ministers are to teach and defend the doctrines of our confession, our catechism, and our canons in the pulpit every Lord's Day, in teaching catechism to the youth, as the church order requires us to do, to in our catechizing of new members, in our teaching various Bible studies, but also in writing, as the form assumes that those who sign that form are going to write something. And for us, for many of us, that might merely be writing something on a website, or writing something for a church newsletter, or writing something in the church's bulletin. For some of us, we might have a chance to write for more popular magazines, or maybe you might write a journal article someday, or even a chapter in a book, or even a book itself. So the form of subscription assumes that ministers not only minister the Word in an oral way, but also in a written way. And we see that throughout the history of the Christian church, just thinking about the Reformation as one great example. Of course, all the first generation reformers like Zwingli and Luther were all pastors and writers. Second generation guys like Calvin, and then later on into the third generation, leading into early Orthodoxy. These men were ministers of the gospel, but they wrote. Some of them wrote basic, we would see it as a pamphlet today that would fit on a literature rack. They weren't large works by at all, but they wrote small catechisms. They wrote explanations of things. They published single sermons on various subjects and passages and topics. So the forefathers that we have as Protestants, as Reformed Christians, all show us that ministers should and are able to put things into print. One of my favorite examples is my favorite of the English Puritans, John Owen. Let me just give you a brief rundown of some of his writings. While he was a minister, you might know that after he left Oxford during the time of William Laud's ascendancy, he was a chaplain, and then he became a pastor in a few churches. He was then a chaplain for Cromwell in the army. Then he was vice-chancellor and dean at Oxford University in Christ Church. At the end of his life, after the great ejection, he became a minister in a congregation for the last 20 years of his life. Well, skipping over the Oxford period, just think about him as a minister of the gospel, preaching in various congregations, but then also writing. So one example of that is his first work, which is called A Display of Arminianism. You may have read that, or may have heard of that. He wrote that while he was a chaplain, his second chaplaincy for a man named Lord Lovelace of Hurley. It's a little town near London. He wrote that first work. And then after that, after the Civil War began, he had to sever ties with Lord Lovelace, because Lord Lovelace was a royalist, and Owen was a parliamentarian. So Owen eventually ended up in a little congregation in a town, a rural town called Fordham. And he wrote there two short catechisms, a lesser catechism and a greater catechism, really ingenious titles, lesser and greater. The lesser catechism is really like two or three pages, very basic. And the greater catechism is a little longer, but still very basic. He also wrote a treatise to his, and this is written for his church. He would go around and catechize from house to house. He also wrote a little treatise called The Duties of Pastors and People Distinguished. In a second church in a town by the name of Coggeshall, he had a congregation of about 2,000 people. That was the parish, that's the region. He also had a smaller gathered church. He was a congregationalist. But he wrote the treatise that we're probably most familiar with his name is The Death of Death and The Death of Christ. He also wrote several practical treatises while he was there. After Charles I's head was taken off, he preached before Parliament the next day, and he published his sermon, and appended to that sermon was a little treatise. Again, he's a pastor at this time. A treatise called Of Toleration, The Duty of the Magistrate About Religion. Became a chaplain for Cromwell, the new model army, and he wrote a response to Richard Baxter. So Baxter gave a peer review of his book, The Death of Death. Wasn't very impressed by it, and wrote a long treatise in response. So Owen felt the need to respond. While he was in Ireland, he was sick most of the time, so he was there in the castle of Dublin. And so he wrote while he was bored in the cold weather of Dublin. He wrote The Death of Christ. So he wrote The Death of Death earlier, and then he wrote The Death of Christ, which is a response to Baxter's Of the Death of Christ. So not to confuse them all, but that's just the way it goes in the 17th century. The last phase of his life, the last 20 years or so, was the greatest output of his lifetime in terms of publication. He pastored, first of all, he was in a little town, his hometown, for about 3 or 4 years. Eventually made his way down to London, began a church there, had about 60 or 70 members in his congregation. Eventually, there was another known Puritan who died, William Carroll, and then the two congregations merged. But at the end of his life, there were about 200 to 300 members. So just to encourage those of you who want a church plant, over the last 20 years of his life, the last 10, when those two churches merged, he gained about 10 members a year. So John Owen, 24 massive volumes that you can go in the library and look at, he gained about 10 members to his congregation per year. He wrote in the last phase of his life as a pastor, his brief instruction in the worship of God, also known as the Independence Catechism, because of its definitive nature in terms of church government and worship practices of the congregational churches. He also wrote his definitive work on justification, the doctrine of justification by faith. He wrote his 4-volume commentary in Hebrews. We know it as 7 volumes, but 4 volumes originally. Some of them are published posthumously. Then his 9-book series that we know as his work, Pneumatologia, on the Holy Spirit. So you can see those all in the library. But at the end of his life, when he's pastoring a small church, but still some size in London, in great political turmoil, great upheaval, he published massive works, works that still stand today and are being read and being dealt with. So writing is an extension of the ministry of the Word. We see the examples of the Bible. We see examples in the Reformation. And we see the examples in the post-Reformation saints, such as John Owen. Any comments or questions? Well, okay. You guys are an easy crowd. I anticipate all of your collected works one day then, if you're going to take me this seriously. Second of all, some benefits of the pastor as a writer. So I'm assuming, and it's a conviction of mine, that the minister should write. It's an extension of his ministry of the Word. Well, what are the benefits of writing? Maybe I'm not a very good writer. Again, just to encourage you, I failed at seminary the writing, the intro, the writing, you know, you have to submit some kind of public, some kind of a writing to get into seminary, right? There's the introduction to writing course. Your mom teaches that still?
Yeah.
Maybe? I had Dr. Jones' wife. I have this great paper, great in my mind at least. It's great, you know, majestic journal article quality paper that I submitted. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to fail this thing. I'm going to pass this thing with flying colors. I'm out of here, you know. It's going to be so easy. I also failed the English Bible survey. Don't tell anybody that. And I bombed with flying colors, so I had to sit through that class. And, well, here I am now. So just to encourage you, you're going to fail more than you're going to succeed as a writer. So a couple practical points. What are the benefits of the pastor being a writer? And just two benefits that I see. First of all, it's another means of ministering to people. Just another way, another avenue, another vehicle. They can hear you. They can see you when you go to their house. They come to your house. But they can also read what you have to say. Assuming, of course, they want to hear what you have to say. So it's another way of ministering to your congregation. And then secondly, to write well, in my opinion, is to preach well. To write clearly is, in my opinion, to preach clearly. Let me give just an example of that. What does it mean to be a Reformed church? You will be asked that. I don't care what church you're in. SMWRC, some church plants in Kauai. You're going to be asked that. What does it mean to be Reformed? What does it mean that you're a Reformed church? And you have to give an answer. People in the foyer want some brief answer that you can then elaborate upon later. They want over the phone. I got a phone call this morning. I heard a message, a girl that wants to join my church. I've never met her, but she wants to know what our church is all about. So I take it with a grain of salt usually when a person says over the phone, I want to join your church, before I've met them. But that's what I have to call her and explain. What is a Reformed church? What does it mean to be Reformed? What is Reformed theology? So after 10 years of feebly attempting to answer the question, trying to find others who have answered it better than I, or find books or articles or anything I could find that could do that, that led to my a book that's coming out. I don't have a copy of it yet, that describes that. And I've come to the conclusion after 10 years that I can summarize to anyone and everyone in any possible way, in any place in the world, when I get asked the question, what does it mean to be Reformed? I can say it in three words. What are those three words? Christian, Protestant, Reformed. That's what it means to be Reformed. I'm a Christian. I can explain that very simply. I'm a Protestant. I can explain that very simply. And I'm a Reformed Christian, Reformed Protestant. So my little book that's coming out, that's the thesis of my book. So hopefully I explain that well. But if you can explain things in a simple way that people need answers to, you know, why don't we believe that the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 are literal? You can give them some, you know, massive book. You can give them Beale's commentary. But trust me, no one in your church is going to read Beale's commentary. You need to be able to give people succinct answers, whether it's by a quick email, whether it's over the phone, whether in person, or even in a sermon. So to write clearly and to write well, persuasively, interestingly, helps you to preach, helps you to communicate in a way that wins people to your position. So let me give you some advice then, just practically speaking, on the pastor becoming a writer. So it's an assumption of mine that it is a ministry of the word. It's beneficial to write as a pastor. And again, that might just be little pamphlets for your bulletin. That might be for actual books. But in some way or another, you need as a pastor to write something and to do it with some conviction. Well, first point of advice is this. You can memorize this little syllogism that I came up with. Every pastor needs to be a writer. I am a pastor. Ergo, I need to be a writer. You can question my premise one, whether every pastor needs to be a writer, but At least I'll assume it's true. So, as ministers of the gospel, we need to write. And again, you might be gifted to write journal articles. You might not be gifted to write journal articles. You might be only able to write for the Sharing Care. That's going to be the URC. You might be able to write for Cursory Renewal. You might be able to write for Westminster Journal. You might be able to do something bigger and better. But whatever your ability is in terms of writing, find your niche and be confident in it. And I say that again as one who failed the entrance writing exam or sample writing here at the seminary. And I look back at my seminary papers and I'm appalled. They're terrible. How did I ever pass seminary? This is absolutely astonishing. They're terrible. They're absolutely atrocious. I would never show them to anybody. And that goes to my sermons too. So just be confident in what your ability is and start small. Okay? Start small. Second point of advice is a point that I learned from my THM advisor, Joel Beakey, who says you need to learn to use everything twice. Learn to use everything twice. Every sermon, every Bible study, every little pamphlet you write for the newsletter, the bulletin, for your website, every little address you give, don't be surprised to see this spin out into something. Use it twice. Find a different venue for it. Everything can be edited and crafted better and can be of some benefit in some way. That might mean that you might have something that you think is decent. You write some great little defense of the real presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper, and you know, that might sit in your shelf for quite a while. You might add to it over the years, but you know, it might be useful in some other venue. That might mean that you preach on something and it was a decent sermon, and you write it, and you might just use it for your church's newsletter. You might not publish it or anything, but you can use what you've done. So don't reinvent the wheel. So what I want to do is just give you an example of that from my own writing, just to show you that everything that I've written, none of these things are original. I didn't sit down to write any of these things. This is not all mine, of course, but I didn't sit down and say, well, I'm going to write a book on infant baptism, and I just cranked it out. I didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write a commentary on the Belgian Confession, and I just sat down and cranked it out. All of these things... you can ask probably anyone in the church. They're regurgitated. Hopefully, it doesn't taste too bad. So, Jesus Loves Little Children. This is the first little book I wrote. This began as a little pamphlet for our literature rack. When we started our church plant, I started writing little pamphlets. Some of them are like one page that you folded. Some of them were like three or four pages. And we had a whole rack of free stuff that we gave out on all kinds of topics. And I found stuff online that I used. And so I wrote infant baptism is a question that you're going to be asked a lot. It's an important topic amongst Reformed Christians and for those coming to our churches, whether they're evangelical, whether they're nothing. They're going to want to know why you baptize kids. They're going to want to know the reasons. And you know, they're going to be appalled and shocked, possibly, to see it. And they want to know why. So there are great things out there. I just wrote my own little thing, writing it for my own context and for those who visit my own church, trying to answer their particular questions. And I didn't really feel like there was a book that explained it the way that people were asking me to explain it. So it turned into a little pamphlet on the literature rack. And then, of course, I got asked that question, you know, more times than I could stomach. So I figured, why should I try to answer people? I can just give them this, right? So that's how that came out, just little by little, from the year 2000 to the day that this was published, I think 2006. So over 4 to 5 years or so, that just sort of develops little by little. And if you've seen this at all, you know my thesis, my purpose is to explain to mostly to explain to evangelicals. That infant baptism is it's just like baby dedication that they're so used to, but it's a little bit more than that. So that was sort of my premise, was to explain to them dedication as sort of an analogy to what we're doing, but then to go off and to explain it in a more full way. And then this little booklet with the Pentecostal hands up in the air, my favorite cover of all. Well, besides the picture of Jesus in the front of that one, which contradicts the other book they wrote, but whatever. At least his head got cut off. There's a couple babies here, a couple of those fat, like medieval angel babies, with a headless guy, but we'll pretend he's not there. So this other one, with the hands, this dude's got a ring on his thumb. It's kind of interesting. This was, again, I wrote a series of just little inserts into our church's bulletin to explain our worship, our, the reasons for Reformed worship and the actual practice of it and what it all means. And those little inserts, they were all one page. I mean, you know, again, start small. They're all just one little insert page. And I wrote a series of articles. I turned those into a series of articles for the Alec magazine. And then that turned into a little booklet. This and the other one, this other one here, I'll explain in just a second. They're the most sort of unique to our church, trying to really explain our own practice. I explain why the pastor wears a robe in this church. Not every minister wears a robe. And I've been told I shouldn't have put that in there, but so it goes. So that's meant to explain to visitors to my church why we do what we do in worship. And this other one, the Good Confession, started off as single handouts, single sheet handouts for membership, new members, with basically an explanation of a doctrine and a couple questions for study and for discussion. And then I got asked just dozens and dozens and dozens of questions about the confessions in our church. So most of the questions that are in this workbook aren't original to me. And there are now members' questions, previous inquirers' questions. And that, again, is our church's membership workbook. So just started off as little inserts and little handouts and small little things. But I couldn't find a workbook that I could use for membership. And I asked around a lot, but nobody really had anything in the URC or, for that matter, that used our confessions. So that one just turned into what it is. One of the funnest sections for me teaching new members is the incarnation and the two natures of Christ. Christology is one of my favorite topics, and it's also a great source of devotion for me. The first time I read Athanasius on the incarnation of the Word, I was sort of turned on to Christology, and a lot of what's in this book are sermons that I preach for Advent and for Christmas. There's my 2 cents on why we should preach the festivals. They can turn it into books. There's some usefulness to it. So I took some outlines and so forth from this Good Confession book on the incarnation and two natures of Christ. I took some sermons that I had, and I wanted to explain to people, it's meant to be read during the Christmas season, what exactly happened when the Son of God came from heaven to earth, and what does it mean that we have that he has two natures, and how can we explain that in a way that makes sense, and why is that important? And even in the last chapter deals with the Quran and the Christ of Islam. So it was meant to be a devotional book and an explanatory book to my own people, but thankfully it was picked up by a little publisher. Mike Brown once asked me what I thought about doing a series of essays for office bearers in our churches to train men to be elders and deacons. And I said, I'm all for it, but I don't want to be the editor. So he became the editor. All I had to do was email him a couple chapters, and I was done, which was the greatest way to write. Just send some other guy your stuff. So this is a great little book. You've probably seen that. I contributed 2 chapters that were things that I had to deal with a lot in the initial phase of our church, explaining to men what it meant that we had 3 offices. And so the opening chapters deals with 3 offices, why we have pastors, elders, and deacons. What their roles are and so forth. And also, you know, the issue of the Lord's Supper and who can come to the table and who can't and why. And try to give a balanced approach to that in that chapter. So, again, but these are things of necessity. These aren't things that, you know, he or I and my own just came up with just to pump out some writing because I was bored. These are things that came out of practical experience. And then this larger book, With Heart and Mouth, is my plea, or I guess it's the fruit of my believing in catechism preaching. So long live preaching the Heidelberg Catechism and the Belgic Confession, Because if you do it, you too can write a large book. I preached the Belgic Confession when we first started in the evening service. I didn't preach the Catechism. Did the Belgic Confession a second time a few years later. And those sermons turned into little articles for the Outlook magazine. Here's my little plug for the Outlook magazine. It's a great little magazine that most people in the URC read. And it's a smaller magazine. It doesn't obviously have a very academic sense to it, but it's a layperson's journal in magazine. That's where I started writing, was in the Outlook. And those little articles then were finished. It took me 3 years to finish those, one chapter of the Confession per month for 3 years. And the publisher asked me to put them into a book. And so I spent some time, doing some more editing and researching. And there you have it. So again, there was like 4 to 5 years of just doing things small and little and one step at a time. And then by the end of it, you have yourself a little book. And then you all remember the Passion of the Christ movie. I was telling somebody this past Saturday, and we had some folks over for lunch, that in the book, there's a website for the Passion of the Christ, which I wish I remember the website address. But long story short, when the Passion of the Christ came out, there was this great website that was going to help all these Christians and churches. Here it is, thepassionoutreach.com. It was going to be, as all the quotes said, perhaps the best outreach opportunity in 2,000 years. The Passion of the Christ, - a lifetime of sermons in one movie. Here's another quote on that website. I have no doubt that the movie will be one of the greatest evangelistic tools in modern day history. I think people will go to it and then flood into the churches seeking to know the deeper implications of this movie. Well, sadly, that website doesn't exist anymore. And I didn't, unbeknownst to me, when I wrote the thing, I mentioned at the beginning that this was just going to be a passing fad in evangelical Christian culture. And I guess I'd become a prophet because the website is no longer there. So I wrote a long pastoral letter to our congregation because I was asked by many people, should we see it? Should we not? Why not? Can I not bring a friend who's not a Christian? Won't it be a great chance and so forth? It's never going to hear the gospel somewhere else. Won't come to church with me. How do I answer this? So I wrote a long pastoral letter and got lots of emails and phone calls and people in the church just really wanted to know. And so that little pastoral letter, I put out for the church to read, and then a few years later, there was another movie. I don't really want to slander it here with a bad word, but it's called Evan Almighty, with Steve Carell playing Noah, the modern-day Noah. And that movie kind of set me off, and I kind of took my old letter, and I wrote a whole bunch more about it. And somebody found out about that, and they asked me to put that into a book. So the point being that you can use everything two times. You don't have to sit down and, I'm going to crank out a book on images of Jesus Christ or whatnot. My latest publication that's not yet in print with Reformation Trust, it's entitled Welcome to a Reformed Church, A Pilgrim's Guide. That was, again, just a way over the years that I have little by little added to a pamphlet that turned into a little booklet I gave out to people who were in my membership class, trying to explain to them what it meant for us to be Reformed, some history, what are our confessions, why do we have these confessions, what are the basic doctrinal emphases, why do we have worship the way we do, what does it mean to live a Christian life as Reformed Christians, is that different or the same as evangelical Christians, or, you guys look kind of Catholic, how does that all fit into what you're doing? And so, again, it just turned into a little page or so on our website, what is a Reformed Church? And turned into something that was a book size. Well, it kind of illustrates to you that you have to that you need to write. Sort of the third practical point: write from your own experience and your own congregational context. I never sat down. I never thought that I would end up writing books per se. I was like to write and wanted to write, but never sat down to. I never had a list of topics. Things just kind of pop in and out of your head, and you might have some interesting material and put it in a file somewhere. I've got 3 or 4 projects and files that have been there for any number of years on my computer that, who knows, may never see the light of day, but ideas that I've had just from preaching and from questions I've been asked, people's curiosities, courses I've taught at the church, Bible studies and so forth. So write from your own experience. John Owen's 19th century biographer, Andrew Thompson, once described this by saying, "A wish has sometimes been expressed that men who, like Owen, have contributed so largely to the enriching of our theological literature could have been spared the endless avocations of public life and allowed to devote themselves almost entirely to authorship. But the wisdom of this sentiment is very questionable. Experience seems to testify that a certain amount of contact with the business of practical life is necessary to the highest style of thought and authorship." He goes on to say, "Most certainly the works that have come from the men of monastic habits have done little for the world compared to the writings of those who have ever been ready to obey the voice which summoned them away from tranquil studies to breast the storms and guide the movements of great social conflicts. The men who have lived the most earnestly for their own age have also lived the most usefully for posterity." So we write from our own experience, our own context. All those things are a part of who we are and what we do. And that's why, you know, writing should never be just stale, should never be abstract, should never be sort of only philosophically oriented above the heads of people. It should always be written passionately, just as you would preach. Writing as if you're writing to one person. When I write an article, a popular article, or a book, I try to imagine one person that has asked me a certain question, and I try to write to that person in the hopes that it transcends that one person to a greater question. But try to think of one person that I am trying to persuade, I'm trying to convict, trying to convince, trying to affect something in their heart or in their minds. So I mentioned earlier in Owen's first church in Fordham, he wrote his two short catechisms. And he wrote those not because he wanted to explain the Christian faith in an abstract, theologically precise way. But he did so because he went there, this is his first parish, his first church, and he described them as being, quote, "full of grossly ignorant persons." So isn't that your dream for the first call that you receive? A church full of grossly ignorant persons. So he sees this and he was appalled, he says, that the previous ministers who had been there, they taught these people nothing, he says. So he sat down thinking of them. He wrote a short catechism, which was mainly for children and older people who had yet to profess faith and come to the Lord's table. And he wrote, that was his lesser catechism. And this greater catechism was written basically kind of in the style of the Westminster Shorter and Larger, one for younger and one for older. One was meant to kind of get a person to the Lord's table, and then one was meant to explain the faith afterwards. And he took those two catechisms, they were published in little pamphlets, and he went from house to house amongst his church, amongst his parish, and he would teach them from that little catechism. So again, he wrote from his own context and his own necessity and his own needs. All right, well, the last point of advice is not one that's original to me, but have you heard of Thomas Sowell? Anyone? Who's not heard of him? Most of you have not heard of him? Just go to T. Sowell. It's T-S-O-W-E-L-L. tsowell.com. Is that Stanford, right? Yeah, Stanford. And he's written like 100 books. Economic books, social books, political books. He's a fascinating writer, phenomenal writer. He has a great essay on that website, just called "Some Thoughts About Writing," and I would really encourage you to read that on your own. It'll really depress you at the beginning because he's honest about himself. Here's a guy who's written like 100 books, and he basically tells you how hard it is. Writing is hard work. Writing is a craft that you need to learn to fail before you learn to succeed. And he describes that. And any writer will tell you that's true. Just to give you an example from my own life, I did submit before I had anything published, of course. I failed first. Several articles to theological journals that were roundly rejected. sent back. Basically, it would have been better to, you know, return it to me, saying return to sender, than me having to read their letters. But that happened before I ever succeeded. But you have to take the comments, all the red lettering, or just the straight out, you know, sorry, thanks, but no thanks, and read between the lines. You wasted our time. And use that to your advantage. To learn to write in a more passionate way, in a clearer way, a more persuasive way. So I was rejected several times by journals before I ever had anything put into print. I recently got a letter from one of the editors of the Westminster Theological Journal. Thanks but no thanks letter. So just to encourage you, once you have something in print, doesn't mean that you're always going to have something in print. So I was shot down like a bad habit. But that's the way it goes. And then also in terms of books, I, again, was roundly rejected. The difficulties of editors and readers and peer review and so forth, as Sowell describes so well in his essay, to send those manuscripts back with lots of comments or no comments before I ever had anything put into print. So. And I look back at this first little book I wrote on baptism, and I think it's terrible. And I hope that one day every copy that they ever printed either is sold or burned so that I can redo the thing, because I think it's horrible, personally. It's got a lot of mistakes and so forth. But thankfully people read it and benefit from it. It's just the way it goes. I've been rejected more than I've been accepted. I recently was rejected again by Erdmans for a book. And someday I'll crack that nut, but I guess not today. Maybe someday. So I have a manuscript that I don't know what to do with. But that's the way it goes. Well, just to encourage you again, whatever level or volume you're able to write as a pastor, as a church planter, in whatever calling God brings you to, I really do encourage you to write, to be clear, to be persuasive, to help you communicate better. It's also rewarding for your own soul to do so. If you have any comments or questions, you know, feel free to ask me or shoot me an email. I'm willing to ask you. And just to also, I maybe should ask, mention, practically speaking, take advantage of the people that you know. Not in a bad sense advantage, but you got professors here that have written a book or two and written some journal articles. They know what it means to be shot down. They know what it means to write clearly and to write well, at least in some of their cases. But ask them to read something that you've written. Get their opinion about it. How can it be written better? How can I persuade? How can I prove myself better? You know, has this been written on before? What else is there on the subject that I can read to compare myself and then to find some different angle to explain what I'm going to do? So take advantage of those that you know. Feel free to ask me. I'm always willing to help any of you at any time, to the best of my ability. But with that, thanks for your attention, and have a great class the rest of the day.
Thank you.